I'm Dave Knudsen, and our guests of the forum tonight are Lois Brokering and Gary Kubley. Lois, you are familiar with, I'm sure, in terms of her sessions on children, self-esteem and feelings, discipline, and by implication also moral development. Gary has been in continuing education here this past month, working on the question of moral development. He's a pastor in southern Minnesota. Tonight, they are going to present some material on stages of moral development. And then, after their presentation, which won't take too long, I thought first we'd try to deal with questions of clarification on what they've said, and then, secondly, ask questions of implications of what they've said. So, turn it over to Lois and Gary.
Well, Gary's going to start.
Okay.
I think I'll just start. I think maybe Evan's definition of morality might be a little helpful right at the beginning here. He talks a little bit about what has been traditionally looked at as being moral and defines that largely in terms of behavior and says that morality has consisted of rules and dispositions to follow rules. It's a guide to behavior. Such morality is sometimes attacked by people who advocate a situational morality, which stresses the decision of the individual in each situation rather than rules. Both moralities, however, are primarily concerned with behavior. What actions or kinds of actions ought I to perform? What ought I to do? Now, he says, obviously, that's important, and then a little further down, he says that he maintains that there is another question that's more important, and that is, what ought a person to be? And he says that an ethic of being precedes an ethic of doing and is every bit as important, and I think that's included in Kohlberg's and Piaget's theories of moral development and the stages of moral development that they present. I guess being in the parish ministry, sometimes talking is something that comes a little easier than it ought to, and so, you know, if I infringe on Lois's time and you see her kicking me on the side here, well, you'll know what's going on. Reminds me of that little, there was a little story that went around quite a while about the two politicians that were given 30 minutes each at a dinner banquet, and the first one talked on and on, using up 30 minutes, finally 40 minutes, and finally 50 minutes, and when the second fellow was introduced, he just had a few minutes left, and he said, well, he came from a farm down in Iowa, and they raised a lot of hogs there, and he said, hogs got up in the morning, and they ate and drank, and then they slept, and then they got up, and they ate some more, and they slept, and that's all they did all day long. And at the end, he said, and the moral of this story is, what's time to a hog? So I don't know if you ought to start or begin by telling a story with a moral when you're talking about moral development, but anyway. I think there is, I have some slight misgivings. Even looking at Kohlberg's stages, I think there's always a danger when you start out in any area, and particularly in an area that you apply to the Christian faith, and I think that these stages can and maybe ought to be applied to the Christian faith in some ways that they have not been traditionally, at least. But, you know, it can, I think, degenerate into a kind of spiritual one-upmanship. There have been movements in the church in the past where persons outside of the movement have looked at members within the movement as somehow saying that they were better than the rest of the folks. And I guess I would hesitate to present these at all if I felt that we could not somehow approach them without looking at them as being somehow, I don't know, somehow this spiritual one-upmanship thing ought to be devoid, I guess, an element that is devoid in this kind of a setup. Well, just looking at Goldberg stages, I think, incidentally, I feel that from the material that I read, which is not vast, I've looked at a few things, but this is a fairly new area for me. But I think that both Piaget and Goldberg have done some research that has been duplicated in other areas that, to me, lends some kind of validity to what they have to say. Well, Goldberg stages then, Goldberg breaks down the three stages that Piaget sets forth into six stages, or three levels are broken down into six stages. The first one is that a child, when they begin to act or react for a reason at all, they act in a given way primarily to avoid punishment. An individual who acts in that way would see the laws of God as being given in order to avoid punishment. And I think you can see some contemporary examples of that maybe. If you remember the television show, I think it was Maud, I remember despising that until my wife pointed out to me that, you know, one of the reasons that they laughed at Maud was because there really weren't too many people around that thought like that. But it always got me when her husband, Walter, would do something and she would respond by saying, "God will get you for that, Walter." You know, and I think, you know, that kind of a statement would be coming out of this kind of a background. You know, if you're not careful, God's going to get you. I think another example might be somebody that says, "Boy, you know, if I didn't believe in God, I'd really have a blast." That kind of a notion. Okay, then I think Kohlberg's second statement, or second stage, is an area where the child or the individual acts not so much from fear of punishment as they do from the promise of a reward. It's embodiment in contemporary idiom might be the notion that if you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. You know, it's kind of it's something that performs an act in order to get something in return. The third stage identifies fairly strongly with a group. Stage two can identify with a group, but it still sees the self as being somehow distinct or separate and doesn't really gear in on that group identity process. But the third stage does pick up on that whole notion of a group, and the family and the church, of course, are some of the first groups that many kids in particular, and even I think adults, could be classified in some ways as still seeing family and church as a group that primarily forms why they respond in a given way. An individual in stage three can and often does act without a promise of reward. I think, Kohlberg would say that the individual's ideals at that stage are somewhat naive and stereotyped. But the intent of an act is also considered in three, and the intent or the motive for an act is important for Kohlberg from this point on. Well, I guess the reason that I didn't stand up to put them on the board is you can't look at anybody when you're standing up.
No,
So that's fine if you like. Well, the fourth stage is primarily law-oriented, and it's a keeping of the law for the sake of the law. Really, the law is seen as the primary adhesive or the primary glue that holds us. And I think individuals who are seen as being primarily in stage four are people who might seem actually kind of cold in their treatment of given individuals, regardless of the motive. They want to see the law enforced. There is something of an almost unquestioning allegiance even of persons within the church to the authority that the church might claim for itself. I think maybe the classic example of a stage four kind of an individual would be the Pharisees of Jesus' day, who were so concerned with keeping the law, and they really felt that keeping the law would be better. It would be better for an individual if they kept the law in isolation than if they could not have any contact with other people and keep the law in their everyday kinds of relationships. Well, then Kohlberg moves on to what he calls the principled thinking stage. He says individuals in that stage, which is his fifth stage, are free from society's views, and they act upon principles which they feel both individuals and the entire society ought to be committed. They might be disillusioned with the society or some of the laws that society has. At this stage, Kohlberg feels that the American Constitution was written primarily out of a stage five thinking. Well, the right is what matters then at a stage five, and personal values other than those that are constitutionally agreed upon, personal values and opinions form what is right for a stage five person. A stage six person, the right is defined by a decision of conscience, and it's done that way in accordance with principles that the individual has chosen themselves. It's seen as having a universal application by the person who holds them. Kohlberg gives an example of Martin Luther King. You know, I hesitate to categorize individuals, but you know, I think Kohlberg uses Martin Luther King as an example of a stage six individual who was very willing to have the principles to which he gave his own loyalty accepted by the rest of society at large. Martin Luther King, as you know, said that there were two types of laws. Some were just and some were unjust, and he felt that an individual had a moral obligation to break unjust laws. Okay. Also, Kohlberg mentions that a stage six individual can and often does have principles, ethical principles, that run counter to the established order. However, he says that basically the individuals at this stage are not governed by an egoistic kind of motive at all, but rather are concerned for a larger block of people. So I think that kind of sums them up in a basic kind of way. So, you know, I'll let you take it from there, Lois.
Well, what I put on the board was, can you see through me or past me? the middle level is called the conventional level, and that's where most the bulk of the population lands. This is an area where children fall in the pre-conventional level, but there are a lot of adults who still work in this area too. Somebody did some research in a prison and discovered that a tremendous number of the people in the inmates of the prison were still functioning at stage one, which says it, you know, it's okay to do it if you don't get caught. The only reason it's wrong is because you get caught.
Yeah.
I figure that cats are at this level and dogs are at this level. You know, for choosing pets for their moral development level, dogs, I think, are at a higher level. You can't get a cat to do anything for a reward, but they'll do something to avoid punishment. The argument against this theory goes that, you know, who's to say that this is any better than this? You see, but that one of the things that Kohlberg says is you can't move up these stages until you grow intellectually, and that's why you don't find children working on the ethical principle levels.
Kohlberg also says that you can have a given act that is desired at any one of those stages, but the motive or the intent is always important.
Well, let's say, for instance, giving to world hunger. this person would give to World Hunger because he feels a great empathy for those hungry people. This person might give to World Hunger because our church is doing it. And this person might give to World Hunger to get a rake off on his income tax. So it's the intent rather than the act that determines the moral level. So that you can't tell from behavior, you know, which stage you're at. You have to look at your intention when you do this. Another thing that I thought was very interesting was that as you move up from one stage to another, you don't just automatically drop the lower stages. I think of myself, you know, why do I stop at a stop sign in a place where there's nobody around, and there's no traffic or anything, and I have to zoom on through? Because I do you have questions about that? I really am no expert on this either. I feel like Gary. I heard a lecture on it some years back, and I thought it was absolutely fascinating, so I wanted to read more about it. And I came up here the next summer, and there was this good book here, which I think we'd both recommend. I loaned it to Gary, and that's where he got the
is basically where I got the outline that I gave you on these six stages.
If I don't think it's in the bookstore anymore, but we probably ought to remind Mary that this is a good, and maybe it's not in the bookstore because it isn't being published anymore. But if you want to write it down, the name of it is Moral Development, A Guide to Piaget and Kohlberg. And it's published by a good Catholic publisher, Paulist Press.
Well, it's written in a language that's easy to understand, too, and I think that's always a valuable.
Kohlberg has not written a book on it, on his stuff himself. I guess he's just done papers and so far has not published the total of his works. So a lot of other people have
done. Yeah, Duska and Whalen allude to this bulky thing that Kohlberg has done, and you know, it led me to believe that maybe it was too heavy to find a publisher.
Yeah, and only PhD candidates wade through Piaget on her own. Anyway, it's the authors are Duska and Whelan, if you're interested in getting it. It's nice, real nice little book on moral development, which has a lot of other stuff that we won't be able to get into tonight. But do you have questions on this that we, you know, might be able to answer? We can try anyway. On the stages.
Are there reasons why a person gets stuck in one stage? Could you talk about that?
Do you want to talk about that? You want me to talk about that?
Well, I assume there could be. You know, do you have? You know, I have some ideas.
Kohlberg's idea of why people get stuck. Well, first of all, you can't move up, according to Kohlberg, any faster than you develop intellectually, which is why you won't find mentally retarded persons, for instance, working at the highest levels, supposedly, and why children work at lower levels. You have to be able to think on an abstract reasoning level before you can get into the higher moral development levels. The reason that there are still adults the lecture, and I threw this out in Gary's session the other day, and someone immediately took issue with it. I'm just telling you what I heard someone say. Don't take this as my opinion particularly, or you don't need to argue with me about it, but the lecturer that I first heard on this used Richard Nixon as an example of someone who had a very high IQ, obviously, or he couldn't have, you know, gotten where he did through school and made the kinds of decisions he had to make as president of the United States, but who was working on a very low level of moral development. He classified him as a stage two. Now, I don't know, you know, on what basis he felt, and this is, I think, what Gary's talking about, the danger of now plugging people, pigeonholing people into particular stages.
But, well, Kohlberg would say that you need to give an individual a wide variety of circumstances and allow them to make their choice as to how they would respond, and then also question them as to what their intent or their motive was at that point.
So you don't judge on one.
So you don't judge on just one instance, no.
Because you see, you occasionally will make a decision on the basis of a stage one above where your top level is, and you very often make decisions on the basis of one below. And you know, like I pointed out with a stop sign, you may work all the way down to the bottom on some occasions, but you tend to make most of your decisions at one stage. but you're constantly attracted to the one immediately above. But Kohlberg feels that we can't comprehend something two stages above. And the reason I thought this information was terribly helpful was because it kind of softened my feelings toward, for instance, the rednecks down south that just, you know, irritate me no end because of their attitude towards blacks and Mexicans and this sort of thing. I've always been very angry about that sort of thing, but when I think of it as a developmental thing, that's where they are, and they can't comprehend how, you know, we would feel here at Holden Village about those people, then it makes me feel more forgiving toward them.
Well, I think, you know, using examples, Kohlberg talks about the Watergate fiasco, and I don't think anybody would disagree in saying that, you know, the individuals involved in that Watergate cover-up made a choice that was in error. You know, they made a wrong choice, you know, or what happened wouldn't have happened. But, you know, when you get to the motives, you know, and you know, what separates them or what makes the difference between what happened at Watergate and what happened with Martin Luther King's followers. And the key to that, as I understand Kohlberg, lies in its universal application. Even the people involved in the Watergate cover-up would not have said it's okay if the public at large does that. You know, they wouldn't have wanted that principle to be applied equally to everybody and said, yeah, it's okay that everybody else out there tap telephones and listen in other ways and deal deceptively with the public at large. They would not have given that right or that possibility to the rest of the public. That's what, you know, that's what Kohlberg would say places that act at one level, whereas, you know, the other act would be at a different level.
We've gotten sidetracked. We still haven't answered your question. What Kohlberg talks about with people getting stuck is the lack of mental stimulation. If the environment allows you to stay, this book points out, what's the movie, On the Waterfront, as an example, where do you remember the hero's name? I can't think of it.
Yeah,
Marlon Brando, whoever he was. He points out that just, you know, if you're not a stoolie, you're okay. I remember a marvelous black lady that helped me when I had a whole house full of babies and lived in Texas, and I could get her for 75 cents an hour. And she said to me one time that her mother said to her, you know, just don't rock the boat. Just keep your place. That was her statement. Keep your place and you'll be all right. Well, you know, if you can have that kind of a statement that says, just, you know, let's keep everything exactly the way it is, then you don't tend to have the dilemmas come into your life that make you question this, because the way you move from one stage to another, or even move up within a stage, because there's a broad range of development even within stages, like anything else, normal isn't right here, it's from here to here. And it's important to remember when you're dealing with kids. as you move up, the thing that makes you move up is that the set of principles on which you are making decisions currently no longer works for you. And it creates what psychologists call cognitive dissonance. You're uncomfortable psychologically. And in order to become comfortable again, you have to now look at some things that you weren't looking at before. You have to look at some new perceptions of life and begin to consider other people's feelings that you weren't looking at before. That makes you rise up. But if your environment does not stimulate that kind of cognitive dissonance, then you probably will be very comfortable staying where you are. He also doesn't put any value judgment on people being at different stages. If it works for you to stay at that stage and you're happy at that stage, then there's probably, you know, that's fine.
One of the authors that it may have been Evans here, I've just been getting into Evans a little bit, but the statement was made that a human being does not make very satisfactory progress on a moral level, you know, and I'm not sure how he defines moral progress, but the statement is made that human beings don't progress very well in a situation of extreme ease, where you never run into any conflict or where nobody ever disagrees with you. You know, if you are raised in a home, for instance, where your parents have attained a level that is comfortable for them, and I think, you know, very often we do, and nobody ever bothers to challenge that you will stay at that level until you're dead, I suppose. But, you know, I don't think you would ever move out of that position.
No, a lot of people don't. You don't have to.
There's no reason to
make you move.
Would Colbert say that there are universal standards of morality that anybody can agree on or that people have agreed on?
I don't know if he would. I don't think so, because he's even considering that there might be a seventh stage beyond this. I think he's more a situational ethics man, but I sure wouldn't. You know, I wish he was here to answer that question, because I don't know the material well enough to answer that.
I don't think he would.
From what you said, it sounds like he's making the distinction between individual moral development and an ethical or moral system that one adopts.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I, you know, it would be in the latter that you would look for universal moral law, I think. And he's just really talking about psychological and intellectual development.
I have a feeling that the answer is no to that question, but I wouldn't.
I was wondering, you know, in the Western world, on the one hand, we have a Greek tradition which says that if you know the good, you do the good. And on the other, I think we have a biblical tradition which says that when you know the good, that doesn't necessarily imply that you do the good. And that we experience a kind of ambiguity at that point, so that we might intellectually know, in the biblical tradition, know what ought to be done here, and at the same time, we don't carry that out. We have a moral ambivalence.
Well, that's, Colbert's research points that out.
Yeah, like
one of the examples that Wells Episcopal is asking a group of adolescents if they felt that seatbelts were a good thing. And most of them said, yes, we definitely ought to have seatbelts. And then they were asked on the next question, how many of you always use seatbelts? And there was absolutely no correlation between people using seatbelts and people thinking that we definitely ought to have seatbelts. So, you know, it seems like we do behave more in the biblical standard than on the Greek standard.
Lois, I came in a couple minutes late, and I apologize for that.
It's just terrible.
We're just getting into stage two of this development. Did you start out with some kind of a statement about morality is?
Yes, Gary read a definition. That's what you wanted to hear, wasn't it?
Would it be terribly implied if I ask, is it long, and would I be boring people?
Everybody who wants to hear it again, say hi. Can you find it?
Well, yeah. I think basically, if you'd allow me just to capitulate a little bit here, I guess what I hear Evans saying in his definition is that traditionally morality has been looked at or defined in terms of behavior. Yeah, he says that it's primarily been looked at as consisting of rules and a disposition to follow rules as a guide to behavior. Then he goes on and says that such a morality is sometimes attacked by people who advocate a situational morality which stresses the decision of the individual in each situation rather than rules. Both moralities, however, are primarily concerned with behavior. What actions or kinds of actions ought I to perform? What ought I to do? Now, he says that that's important, but that there is another consideration that's more important, and that is, what kind of a person ought I to be? I think one of Walt Bowman's statements last week when he was talking about evangelism, he says evangelism is not just what you do, it is also what you are. And I think that's saying the same kind of a thing that Evans is trying to say on what morality is. And I think I can see both kinds of things, what you do and what you are, coming into play in Kohlberg's stages. Now, is that any help at all? Or?
Now, would you tell me whether or not his definition presupposes that morality defines the rule as well as speaks to whether or not you do or do not comply with the rule? Does it furnish the rule as well as the motivation for observing the rule?
I don't think Kohlberg would say
that. I don't think he would either.
So somebody else furnishes the rule.
Well, I think, you know, at given stages, you know, there is a stage at which the family or the society in which you live would furnish the rule.
And the assumption,
or the church, you know, the group.
The assumption then is that the rule, wherever it comes from, is good.
Well, not necessarily.
When we get up here, he says, then you may look at the rules and say, these rules aren't working. They're not good. They're unjust. Therefore, I won't obey them. Rule orientation is very much at stage four, where that's the law and order thing, where you obey
so
things because of society's
really
rules.
So morality really means that I do or don't comply with the rule depending upon the state of my understanding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's where Kohlberg's coming from. I think he would say when he classifies Martin Luther King as a stage six person, and King says that there are some laws that are just and some laws that are unjust, and the person of faith, you know, I think King, coming out of that kind of a background, says that the Christian has a moral obligation to disobey unjust laws.
And the people at the bottom level of development are not really concerned too much about rules. They're only concerned about satisfying their own ego needs.
And that's neither moral nor immoral?
Well, yeah. It's before that, it's amoral.
If they are uninformed enough, even though they're tremendously selfish, that's still moral.
If they're what? I didn't...
If they are uninformed enough, stupid enough, I'm sorry to use that word, but... dull enough, then they can be very selfish and very self-centered. That's still moral because that's their understanding of it.
Well, I suppose society would judge it moral or immoral according to what the behavior was, rather than you know.
Morality is the judgment that society puts on it, rather than the judgment that the person makes about his or her own behavior.
Again, I think that depends on what stage you are. That would be true at stages 3 and 4, but as the individual moves to a different stage of development, then, you know, and becomes more autonomous as an individual, I think then that person's morality, his or her morality, would be shaped more by the ethical principles that are formulated on an abstract level rather than defined by the society in which they live. You know, that may not be much help, but that's the way I read Kohlberg.
I'd like to ask if there's a possibility that we could relate these ideas of stages to Christ's growth in his human life. The writer of Hebrews says, although he was a son, yet he learned as he suffered. Could be a relationship made there?
So you're asking, did Christ move through these stages, or is that the question? Or?
Well, yes, just not what Kohlberg suggested, but just would it be a valid question to ask?
I suppose. I'm not sure I want to try to answer that, but it really sounds like a valid question.
I think you can find some evidence in Scripture to indicate that Jesus responded two people in different ways, but that may have been because he recognized that they were at a different point. When he said to the Pharisees, for instance, that, they were accusing him of doing something good on the Sabbath, and he turned around and said, was the Sabbath made for man, or was man made for the Sabbath?
And he answers his own question and says that man was made for the Sabbath in one of the other Gospels instead of the Sabbath being made for man. And if you have an opportunity to do something for another individual on the Sabbath, why, by all means, go ahead.
You know, we don't have stories of Christ's childhood up until he's 12 years old. And at that point, he seems to have had a rather high level of moral development because he disobeyed his mother and father, who were on their way home, and did something that he thought was more important. He had to be about his father's business, which suggests that he might have already been into stage 5 at age 12, which is terribly precocious, according to Kohlberg.
Yeah.
But, you know, one might expect that of Christ.
That
parents would approve of that at age 12.
That's right. Yeah. It's very unloving of Christ not to tell the parents where he was at.
But see, he was doing something that would have been the higher good, even though he personally was going to get punished for it. And that's, you know, that's what happens in the higher levels. You forget yourself. That's why that's the difference between that and the bottom one, which is egocentric. And this one forgets self totally and puts, sometimes you receive punishment because you're working for the total good and you've got to give up your own.
To answer your question maybe a little more specifically, I think that statement of the Sabbath being made for man and not the other way around is the statement of a stage 5 person to a stage 4 person. You know, I think the Pharisees were very, very rigidly stuck in their stage 4 mentality. But what Jesus is saying when he comes across with an ethical principle like the golden rule, he's saying that can't be fulfilled in isolation. You know, you could lock yourself in the men's room and keep the Old Testament legal order, you know, because you wouldn't have any contact with anybody else, and therefore you could fulfill the letter of the law. You know, and the Pharisees had a group amongst them that were called the Bleeding Pharisees. And they were called Bleeding Pharisees because they thought it was unclean to look at a woman. And so when they saw one coming, they closed their eyes and they ran into trees and walls and all kinds of things. You know, it's kind of, you know, we laugh at that, but they took it very seriously. You know, they were fulfilling the letter of the law, and that was important to them.
One of the things that occurred to me as I read this book and studied this material was that when Christ came with his gospel, that he raised the whole level of morality and the Old Testament morality. But Herb argues with me on this because he says that I'm misinterpreting the Ten Commandments. But it seems like the Ten Commandments are, you know, more stage 4, that it's pretty black and white what you're to do. And then when Christ comes, it seems to me like he raised us to the next stage of moral development by saying, there are only 2 commandments that you need to worry about. But my gosh, you know, what the heck does that mean? You've got to make up your own mind on that. So it's, you know, my feeling is that he was raising humanity in general to another stage. And now I'm beginning to think that with our ability to, you know, totally blow up the world, that it's high time that we now move up to the next stage in our general thing. You know, if it's true that our Constitution is stage 5, then, you know, officially maybe we have moved up a stage, but maybe we need to now move up to stage 6. You know, the whole world does, or we're gonna kill the world, because we have to think of the whole thing. It used to be that we could get by with just thinking about the family or the neighborhood, because you couldn't get any farther than that. You know, people didn't travel very far, most people didn't, so you didn't know what was going on in another country. But now if somebody drops, you know, explodes a bomb to test it or something, you know, halfway around the world, it takes about 17 days for that stuff to go clear away around the world, and we've got, you know, what is it, strontium something or other ruining our milk and so on.
I guess, excuse me, I have my hand up first. I guess then basic morality would be for us to live at the highest level of which we are capable, at least at the stage we're in, and not regress, because like the Bible says, to him who knows to do good and does it not, to him that's sin. So always try to live at the highest level that we are at, and that's morality, and we become immoral if we regress because then we feel guilty and we know we're not living at our highest and best.
Yeah, and you really can't live any higher.
And we can't judge others because we don't know always what the stakes are in.
Or what their intent is. You can't judge by behavior.
Yeah.
And is it up to us to judge others anyway? That's what Gary was saying. Mm-hmm. He worries about reading this, that we'll start judging other people.
Well, I think the grace of God is operative regardless of what mm-hmm. stage you're at, I guess, and I would like to make that as clear as possible, I guess. I think God can meet an individual wherever they are.
I may be too practically oriented, but I'm still back on the statement about the research of the inmates in prisons. And I've read other studies that talk about all the dollars that society is putting into keeping those people there. And I've also done some reading about what kind of rehabilitation is going on there. I'm wondering how that all fits with how do we move people as a society from this level one to somewhere beyond that, to the point that they are not repeaters or mm-hmm. are not harmful to others.
Well, Kohlberg would say, you present them with dilemmas, is what he calls them, little scenarios that cause them to see that their stage of reasoning doesn't work very well. But it has to not work for them. But you do this by role play and discussions and trying to bring up things that out of their own life. You do this with children too. There's a whole book that was written by somebody, and I don't think they did this in terms of moral development. They were thinking more of social development, but it seems to me like it has great implications for developing children's ability to make moral decisions as well.